Hello, Joe. What do you know? Welcome to the Bogart Film Affair.
That's right, baby.
What's all the fuss about?
Relax, Jack. Have another drink.
It smokes, it drinks, it philosophizes.
You mind telling me what it is I'm supposed to have done? At this rate, I'll be 60 before you get to the point.
Welcome, everybody, to the third episode of the Bogart Film Affair. This week, we're talking about the cult classic 1953 Beat the Devil, starring Bogart and Peter Lorre, Jennifer Jones, Gina Lollobrigida, and lots of others, directed by regular Bogart collaborator John Huston. Now, I think the term cult classic is usually applied to films where everybody hates the film when it first comes out, but over time it grows on a small section of the audience and then just continues to steamroll to really be loved, you know, maybe not by the masses, but by a large portion of the masses. I've never been a huge fan of cult classics. Plan 9 from Outer Space, not my cup of tea. Rocky Horror Picture Show, I got to admit that I really hated it the first time I saw it, and I've never really enjoyed it upon subsequent viewings. I've done the private home showings where, you know, a good friend says, oh, you got to watch this, it's hilarious. I've done the theater thing in college where you go to the theater and people are throwing toast, and I don't like it. Not my cup of tea. But this one I would put more in line with something like The Big Lebowski, where maybe the world didn't know what it was watching the first time it saw it, but the world was wrong. At the time of its release, all the fans kind of turned on it. Theater owners turned on it. They gave refunds to people who saw the movie and didn't like it. They put up signs that apologized for taking people's money to show the movie. Even Bogart wasn't sure exactly what the film ended up being. He referred to it as a complete mess. There's definitely an interesting tone with this one. You know, when people ask me, what's the deal with Beat the Devil? What's my opinion on it? A lot of times I'll tell them, go into the film expecting to see a mashup of Wes Anderson's quirky comedy, the Coen brothers' dark humor, and Robert Altman's occasionally wandering dialogue and scenes. John Huston brought in Truman Capote to work on the script day-to-day, and it adds a really interesting element, a lot of very Capote-ish humor, while at the same time you get scenes that will literally break away mid-conversation. You get conversations like Peter Lorre's that might just end abruptly mid-sentence as he leaves the room to go meet his companions. It's just, I think the film was ahead of its time. And part of the evidence behind this was critics at the time really enjoyed the film. A lot of critics said it was fantastic. It was wonderful. It was very funny. The whole humor thing, I don't understand how people missed it. I guess it's kind of hard to look back and understand how, you know, somebody watching and listening to Jennifer Jones talk about how desperate these villains must be because they didn't look at her legs. You know, to Bogart's rub-a-dub-dub, 3 men in a tub, you know, the three main villains besides Bogart, the three desperados headed to Africa. It just seems ridiculous. You wouldn't just instantly look at those three guys, Robert Morley and Peter Lorre and Marco Tulli, and even, you know, the tiny Ivor? Is that how you... I-V-O-R. Ivor Barnard as the diminutive Major Jack Ross, the assassin amongst the group who Bogart especially dislikes. I'm kind of thrown by the fact that people watch this. I don't know if, confused about whether it was comedy or drama or action. I mean, it's got elements of all that, but there's clearly a lot of tongue-in-cheek humor going on here. What on these podcasts, I'll read you the plot synopsis from the Bogey Film Blog where I wrote it up. But first, I want to read you the plot synopsis on imdb.com, which I think usually does a pretty good job of summing up film plots in one sentence, if not two, maybe three, if they get really extravagant or if it's a complicated plot. But just to show you how divided I think society is on this film, this is the extremely brief and vague plot synopsis written on IMDb that I think was probably written by one of those people who saw the film and did a double take and wondered what in the world is going on here. So this is IMDb's description of Beat the Devil. On their way to Africa are a group of rogues who hope to get rich there and a seemingly innocent British couple. They meet and things happen. They meet and things happen. They meet and things happen. That's it. That's all they wrote. This was clearly someone who'd sat through this film to do a summary and went, I don't know what's going on here. And I'll be the first to admit, the first time I saw this film, I wasn't a huge fan. I was a little confused. But I will say that almost all the Bogart films I'd seen before were exclusively the major iconic classics. Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep, The African Queen, High Sierra. And this is definitely not in that vein. If anything, I would say this is probably more in the vein of, some of Bogart's goofier comedies, All Through the Night, or maybe even Were No Angels. Bogart wanted John Huston to direct the film. Huston was kind of caught up working on another film with Katharine Hepburn. Hepburn stepped aside so Huston could work on this one with Bogart. From the Sperber Lax Bogart biography, I think that Huston wasn't exactly sure what he was getting into. There was a lot of script issues. They brought in Truman Capote, who was already in Europe working on another film, to do daily rewrites. And if you read a lot of the backstage stuff, the behind-the-scenes stuff about Capote on the film, it's a lot of fun, him horsing around with John Huston or, his relationship with Bogart. Apparently he beat Bogart in arm wrestling 3 times in a row, and that was all Bogart needed to know, that he could trust and have fun with this guy. The Capote humor here is, I think, really evident and a lot of fun. You get a lot of really wry throwaway lines by Bogart. He was an orphan and then adopted at age, I think it was 20, by a wealthy woman. You get a moment where, Bogart says, "The only thing standing between you and a watery grave is your wits, and that's not my idea of adequate protection." I'm not going to do a Bogart impression. I can't do one. Oh, here it is. "I was an orphan until I was 20. Then a rich and beautiful lady adopted me. They're English, going out to the British East. They have a coffee plantation. There's a certain type of Englishman that goes off to coffee plantations without caring if there's any money in it or not. Relatives leave them coffee plantations, and they go out to them." It's just a style of dialogue, that's would almost be more in place, in Alan Alda's MASH TV series than it is here, or a Coen Brothers movie. A lot of, quick one-line, occasional double entendre, So Bogart wants Huston for this one. Huston brings in Capote. Apparently there was a short amount of time where Huston didn't know if he was going to be able to get out of the Hepburn picture. So he said maybe, and they'd come to Bogart and asked about possibly Nicholas Ray, who Bogart had worked with a couple of times. I can imagine that might have been pretty good. That might have been an interesting movie. Nicholas Ray was a great director. I loved In a Lonely Place. But that's all beside the point. Here's the plot that I wrote for the Bogey Film Blog. 4 crooks meet up with a British couple as they make their way from Italy to East Africa in order to obtain and exploit uranium-rich land. Billy Dan, rather, Humphrey Bogart, finds himself pinballing between the 3 crooks he's traveling with, his wife, played by Gina Lola Brigida, and the con woman, Jennifer Jones, who continually feeds him lies while simultaneously professing her love for him. So it's 4 crooks, 5 if you count the little assassin traveling with them. 5 crooks, a British couple, and Gina Lola Brigida trying to get out of Italy on a ship that continually is breaking down, providing a ton of comedy. Again, how do you not recognize this as a comedy? A ship captain who's constantly drunk and only has 1 volume, and that's, level 10 full volume, screaming at everybody at the top of his lungs, trying to get to Africa to kind of swindle, exploit. Bogart's Billy Dan, rather, has this friend in Africa who apparently can hook him up with a land deal that's going through, that they can buy some uranium. Bogart doesn't have the money, so the Robert Morley's character, apparently is going to fund a lot of this. So from the very beginning, things are a little bit complicated. I don't want to say it was a mess, because you have John Huston, you have Bogart, you have Peter Lorre, you have Truman Capote, you have Robert Morley, Jennifer Jones, you have a whole group of people here who are class acts, who are geniuses, who know what they are doing when it comes to filmmaking. I think the trouble was Houston hadn't really done a movie with this tone yet. So I don't want to say that the comedy confused him, but, you know, watching it, you can tell that he's not quite as confident as he was in, say, you know, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre or The Maltese Falcon. There's definitely a darker, more subtle comedy to the film, you know, in line, like I said, with Wes Anderson or the Coen brothers, where you're not being slapped in the face, you know, with over-the-top physical humor. There's a lot of, it's a lot of dialogue. It's Truman Capote humor, I think, is what it is. You know, another issue that they had at the beginning was, I guess Bogart brought it up to Houston, you know, should we do this one in color? Color pictures were huge, making a lot of money. Houston was apparently filming Moulin Rouge at the time and was having a lot of issues. You know, it was a complicated process, complicated and expensive, and he was getting kind of sick of it with Moulin Rouge. So it sounds like, you know, at least from the Sperber Lax biography, that he just kind of threw his hands up in the air and said, no, I'm done with color. We're doing this in black and white. I don't mind so much that it's black and white. I love black and white films. I will say, you know, one of the main characters in this film is Italy. The Italian countryside plays a huge role. There's a lot of cliffside shots. There's a great shot of Bogart and Jennifer Jones leaning over the railing at a villa. There's a, you know, a great Italian restaurant. There's a ton of scenes shot outdoors in Italian cafes, on Italian streets. Most of the main conversations happen with gorgeous scenery in the background. Would it have been better in color? I don't know. The scenery would have looked better. I know that for sure. You know, I've talked to people, you know, on Twitter and on the blog who say, I don't know, a star like Bogart, it's weird seeing him in color, which I kind of agree with. You know, Barefoot Contessa might have benefited from being a black and white film. We're No Angels, I like that one in color. It's fine with me. It doesn't really bother me either way. I think for the sake of the scenery here, though, you know, the Italian and then at the end of the film, the African scenery probably could have benefited from some color. It could have been, you know, despite its complicated, goofy plot, you know, maybe one of those lavish scenery-filled films that people say, well, I don't get what's going on, but you got to go see it on the big screen because it's fantastic. It looks beautiful. It's also fun to note that on this film, apparently Bogart was involved in a pretty serious car accident when they weren't shooting. There's a famous car wreck in the scene with the car going over the cliff, but there was another time they were just driving around the winding roads of Ravello, Italy, and the driver reached a fork in the road and instead of going right or left, plowed straight through a stone wall, and Bogart's face was slammed into, you know, I don't know if it was the seat in front of him or the dashboard or whatever it was, but bit through his tongue, smashed out some of his front teeth, had to have his teeth replaced, had to have his tongue sewn up, which according to Hollywood lore, he did without any sort of anesthesia. And in the Lax biography, he even goes on to say that Houston was apparently in the car with him, and when he turned and saw Bogart's puffy, bloody face, he just broke out laughing. Those two guys apparently had a really interesting work dynamic, friendship. Both big drinkers, but, you know, at least according to Lax anyway, Bogart was always trying to impress Houston or get Houston to believe that he was a real man. I don't know if that's true. I would think at this age, you know, everybody kind of gives Bogart the benefit of the doubt that he's a tough guy. But breaks his teeth, gets his tongue sewn up. And one of the greatest stories, I think, of all from this movie is during post-production, the injury made Bogart lisp a little more. He was a little tougher to understand, so Houston brings in a very young Peter Sellers to do a Bogart impression during post-production to fix up some of his lines. And the impression is so amazing that I guarantee you when you watch the film, you won't be able to tell which lines are Bogart's and which lines are Sellers. Apparently he didn't do a lot of lines, but it's near on impossible. Only Houston and Bogart, I guess, really knew when Sellers was stepping in to do the lines. I've got some suspicions about certain scenes, especially the scene at the end where Bogart's been beaten up by some police in Africa, and his face is bloody and his lip is puffy. You know, I don't know. I don't know if that was one of those scenes or if that was all completely makeup. I'm not sure. But it's pretty neat to know that Peter Sellers was behind the scenes there working on that with Houston and Bogart. Apparently, when it came to casting, there was some goofiness going on, too, behind the scenes. You know, the Jennifer Jones character, Gwendolyn Chelm, one of the two British folks that's trying to get to Africa with Bogart and his crew, they weren't sure who to cast with that. Even Bogart even suggested maybe Lauren Bacall play the role, but it was totally up to Houston. They ended up going with Jennifer Jones, supposedly because she was married to David O. Selznick, who ran Selznick Studios in Hollywood, and he pushed pretty hard to get Jennifer Jones into the film. I think she did fantastic. However they got people into this cast, it worked. I even like Gina Lollobrigida, even though I guess critics at the time were pretty hard on her portrayal. You can tell she struggles quite a bit with the English language, but I don't think she was distractingly bad. I thought she was very believable as a woman who would fall for Bogart and, you know, not really love him, but be with him for, you know, I don't know. She fell for his charm for a little while, or the fact that he was possibly going to be rich, or he was rich and lost his money. The other interesting casting note is Peter Lorre, who supposedly was making... He wasn't making a lot of films at this time, but his going rate was $50,000. And at the time in Hollywood, I guess it wasn't as strange for one Hollywood agent to be representing multiple people in the same deal. So John Huston's agent was also Peter Lorre's agent. So knowing that John Huston wanted to save money, or being asked to save money for Huston's film, the agent went and convinced Peter Lorre to knock down his usual acting price of $50,000 by over half, like almost a third to more than a third, for $13,000. And Lorre was, you know, doing some theater and some radio, and apparently, you know, was just looking for an opportunity to go make a film like this with a bunch of his friends. So he was happy to go, but kind of talked him down in a sneaky way. The film is essentially a film about deception, about lies, about lying to other people, about lying to yourself. You know, and the main triangle of liars in this film is Robert Morley, Jennifer Jones, and Humphrey Bogart. Each, you know, Morley outright lying to make a buck, to make $1 million, hopefully, to be a thief, to be a murderer, to keep his cronies in line. Jennifer Jones lying because she just desperately wants a better life. And instead of, you know, working towards it or waiting for it, she just constantly is inventing this better life for herself, that they are English nobility, that they are wealthy, that she constantly knows more about the world than she really knows so that people will respect her. And then you have Bogart, who seems to be playing a liar, but at the same time, everything you think is a lie ends up being true. He used to be a wealthy villa owner and own a restaurant, and he owned a car that he gave to his driver. And, you know, as the film goes on, you're finding out more and more that things he's saying are true. So then you start to wonder, well, what exactly happened to bring him from being this wealthy landowner to kind of a middle-of-the-road swindler that's heading to Africa for a uranium deal? People love him. The restaurant owner, the guy who owns the restaurant that Bogart had purchased and turned over to him just because he loved his cooking, loves Bogart. Everybody in Italy seems to know him and love him. What was his downfall to lose all his money? I don't know. It's not really made clear, and that's part of the great aspects of the character. It's definitely an ensemble piece, and the ensemble is what's important, and the ensemble works. I think one of Houston's huge gifts is being able to take a smaller cast and hear, you know, Marco Tulli, Ivor Barnard, Peter Lorre, Robert Morley, Humphrey Bogart, Jennifer Jones, Gina Lollobrigida. I guess it's not that small, but they're pretty much the main characters in the film. There's not a lot of side characters who show up here. Most of this film is conversations between those six or seven characters. Houston is amazing at taking a cast like this, a core group, and really giving each of them their time to shine. I mean, he spends a lot of time away from Bogart in this film, building up Morley and Lorre and Tulli. And even Tulli, who's not in a ton of this film, gets a few moments right at the end of the film where all of his stoic, straight-faced, deadpan demeanor pays off with this beautiful, huge smile and a couple of lines at the end. Houston, I think, was fantastic at taking each actor's specific skill set and really letting it shine to its fullest. Another great asset to the film community, and also a detriment at the same time, is that Beat the Devil, the copyright expired. The folks who own the copyright didn't renew it in time, and this is now a public domain film, meaning this film is everywhere. I mean, you go on Amazon and search Beat the Devil, you go on eBay, tons of production companies have put DVDs out. Some of them are horrible because they're copies of copies of copies of copies. They're super scratchy, hard to understand. Some are fantastic. There's a few pretty good copies of this film available to view on YouTube, even. When I want to watch it, and I watched it twice in the last week, I go to YouTube, and there's a couple really clean, nice copies there. There's even an app at the iTunes store for $1, and it's just a Beat the Devil app where you just literally download the movie to your device, and you own it for $1. You know, there's this weird part of me that every time I'm searching for certain Bogart films on eBay or Amazon, you know, with so many companies putting this film out, every company has their own variant cover for the DVD case. Some of them are the poster for the film. Some of them are, you know, somebody's awkward photoshopped screen cap, you know, from the film. And I, for some reason, I'm just intrigued by these dozens of different covers for Beat the Devil. And if I had more spending money, if I wasn't, you know, broke most of the time, there's this part of me that just wants to collect every single different cover of Beat the Devil, even though you don't need more than one copy of this film. You don't even need a copy of this film. It's in public domain. You can get it anywhere. I don't know why I have that obsession, but, you know, maybe someday if I win the lottery or, you know, some benefactor, you know, maybe I'll be adopted, you know, at 40 by a rich and wealthy woman who will say, yes, I'll make all your dreams come true, even the ridiculous ones. Who knows? Bottom line, you got to check this one out. It's fantastic. Beat the Devil. A cult classic in every sense of the word. It deserves to be seen by every self-respecting Bogart fan and classic film fan. And I'm even going to tell you, give it more than one viewing, especially if you're not a huge fan to start with. I think I gave this one 3.5 bogeys on the bogey film meter on the blog. Not a perfect Bogart fix, but pretty doggone good.
Oh, why, of course.
Like I said before, the cast here is fantastic. I think, first off, you have to mention Robert Morley. Now, it's going to be impossible to watch this film and not look at Robert Morley acting alongside of Peter Lorre and keep saying to yourself, this could have easily been Sidney Greenstreet. This could have been Greenstreet and Lorre in this film together. Morley and Greenstreet, a somewhat similar acting style, very similar in looks and size, both very big men. I think, though, what Morley brings to this is a bit of a seedier side to this character. I think Greenstreet could have played it pretty underhandedly. I think he would have been fantastic, but I think you see Greenstreet in any Bogart film, it's hard not to love him, even when he's the villain. I think it would have been the same here. Morley brings much more of a, you know, kind of a used car salesman quality to the role of Peterson, the guy who's bankrolling this whole heist. You know, and it's great to see him again. You know, I think the only other film he's appeared in with Bogart is The African Queen, where he plays Katharine Hepburn's reverend brother. I think his name was Samuel Sayer. And there's a great joke here that's had to have been intentional. I can't imagine this was an accident. One of Jennifer Jones's great fibs during the film is she tells various characters that she and her husband are heading to Africa for different reasons. And at a cafe sitting next to Robert Morley, when he's trying to figure out why she's going to Africa, she tells him that she and her husband are going because of sin, because they're, you know, redeeming themselves by going to Africa to spread the word of God to the Africans there. And the look on Robert Morley's face, you know, he's completely aghast and shocked. It's a wonderful moment. It has to be an in-joke about his short role in The African Queen, where he's playing a missionary to the African people, to a small tribe there. He's fantastic in the role. I would have loved to see one more Greenstreet Lorre Bogart film, but I can't fault a single second of Robert Morley here. In fact, he plays this role so well. I didn't realize how much I loved him in the film until about the third or fourth time I saw it, because he just plays someone you want to hate so well that sometimes those roles trick me into actually disliking the actor until I go, no, no, this is what he's supposed to be doing. These are choices he's made. This is a very different role than the Reverend in The African Queen. He's making me despise him. He's making me feel like my skin's crawling every time he gets his way. So I loved Robert Morley. Jennifer Jones, I think you have to mention next as the young Mrs. Gwendolyn Chelm, married to Edward Underdown, who's playing Harry Chelm, kind of a very prim and proper English man who's headed to Africa. Supposedly they're going to visit a coffee plantation that he owns. We're led to believe he seems much more renowned and important back in England than he actually is. Jennifer Jones, as I mentioned earlier, got the role probably because her husband, David O. Selznick, kind of pushed Houston to give her the role. I think she does really well. Could Bacall have played it better? I would have loved to have seen another Bogart-Bacall collaboration. I think she would have been fantastic. But again, I think Jennifer Jones brings a little bit more of a naive quality that Bacall probably wouldn't have been able to pull off. She's very young, or at least appears very young in the film. Her husband seems much older. She's falling for a much older Bogart. Almost in the same vein as Betty Davis in The Petrified Forest, except perhaps this would be a Davis that has been a little more bruised by the world and has maybe lost her sense of self and honesty a little bit. Jones is very funny here. Numerous funny lines in the film. Good grief, she's so cute with every little lie she tells, and when she starts on a roll of point of fact, and you just know that some whopper of a lie is going to pour out of her mouth. I love it. I'm glad her husband pulled strings to get Houston to put her into the film. Edward Underdown playing her husband Harry, another fantastic role in the film, another Robert Morley-ish type actor who you're just watching, getting just so annoyed with until you realize he's doing a good job. We're meant to be annoyed with him. His final scenes on the boat, and then the major twist that he plays into at the end of the film. If nothing else, you have to give Edward Underdown credit for playing Harry Chelm. Full tilt. What, by the way, is a chill on the liver, which he gets twice during the film? That's got to be an old-fashioned saying, a chill on the liver. You know, I can't even imagine what that would feel like. I've had chills, but they kind of run the whole body. I've had, you know, pains in my sides, but you wouldn't describe a pain in your liver as a chill in your liver. I don't know. It's a great phrase. Makes him seem extra snooty and snobby and less likable. But at the same time, you're rooting for the poor guy because he's the underdog and he really gets battered around in the film. Peter Lorre playing Julius O'Hara. Another great tidbit in this film is how often the Nazis are referenced. And Peter Lorre, you know, is having this constant argument with Ravello, played by Marco Tulli, about the pronunciation of his name. Tulli continues to say O'Hora, and he corrects him with O'Hara. And then you even get this tidbit when Lorre's talking to Bogart, where he says that there are a lot of great Germans in Argentina now with the name O'Hara. You know, kind of alluding to the fact that all these Germans disappeared from Germany after the war and went into hiding with new names. And not only that, but you get to Ivor Barnard's Major Jack Ross, the little assassin, who's constantly bringing up how much Hitler and Mussolini were just these great leaders. And he believes that Robert Morley's Peterson is next in line to be a great leader alongside of Hitler and Mussolini. So a lot of really fun wry humor, which maybe, now that I think about it, that might have tied in a little bit with the audience's taste then, that they weren't quite ready to laugh at goofy characters who love the Nazis, maybe. Especially since we don't see the Nazis, or we don't see them getting beaten up and all through the night. You just hear them referenced in funny ways. But Lorre is fantastic. It's the last collaboration he has with Bogart. He's older, he's larger, his hair is white. He's constantly smoking out of one of those Audrey Hepburnish long-handled cigarettes, and he has some just incredible lines in this film that I have no doubt came from Truman Capote. Probably the most memorable lines of the film, especially the one about time and what he considers time to be. Just iconic classic lines. Gina Lollobrigida It sounds like she maybe got the role to really help the European sales of the film. She was told, she was convinced to do the role, I guess, because she was going to be given top billing in Italy, which was very important to her. I think she does fine. She plays kind of an airheaded, you know, sidekick wife to Bogart. They probably could have found, they definitely could have found a stronger actress for the role. But, oh, good grief. The scene on the dock where Jennifer Jones and Lola Brigida are both in bathing suits sunning themselves, and Jennifer Jones starts working out with these kind of boat rocking sit-up knee crunch. I'm not sure what they are, but you know what? I'm going to give everybody in this film a big break. That scene alone, to watch those two beautiful women lay there in bathing suits, one of them working out, I give her a pass. She was fine. She was okay. I have no complaints. Marco Tulli, as I said, played Ravello. You know, tall, thin, almost Frankensteinish looking, very deadpan face. You know, all of his deadpan looks, his dour expressions really pay off at the end when they're being interrogated by the African authorities. And he finally gives us that great big toothy smile when he's trying to pretend to be an innocent man and not a desperate criminal. Really, really fun. And Ivor Barnard steals nearly every scene he's in as Major Jack Ross. The little ex, I think he's ex, he says Indian Army. I think he must have fought with the British in India. The assassin in the movie who Bogart is just having a blast, needling about his size the entire film. Definitely a standout scene stealer, Ivor Barnard. And then you get Bernard Lee at the end of the film as Inspector Jack Clayton, the guy who finally catches up with all these criminals in Africa and ends up arresting him. And we never get the full story of why Bogart gets away with it and everybody else gets arrested. It seems odd here. We're obviously left to assume that he and Jennifer Jones were able to lie their way out of it. But with a very tiny role, Bernard Lee is very good as the inspector from Scotland Yard who rounds up all the criminals at the end of the film. Of course, most cinema fans will remember him as M in you know, a handful of Bond films. One of those actors who was able to bridge the gap between the classic Hollywood era through the 60s and into the, you know, the auteur 70s filmmaking era. You know, and I'm not saying Bond is auteur filmmaking, but, you know, that's probably his most famous role, or at least where most lay people, most, you know, casual fans would know him. So what's the Bogart factor here? It's pretty big. He's fantastic in the film. It's mostly comedic role for him. As I mentioned before, we never really know what the backstory is on Bogart's character. It's one of the mysteries of the film. He was wealthy, he was loved, and now he's poor and still loved. Where he picked up Gina Lola Brigida, I don't know. But they work pretty well as a couple. They both seem to disdain each other an equal amount while at the same time having some pretty genuine affection towards one another. I think one of the most interesting moments is at the very beginning of the film, the first scene Bogart's in, he's actually angry and upset. They read about a murder back in England committed by Robert Morley and Peter Lorre and Marco Tulli and Ivor Barnard. And it's an associate of theirs. And, you know, Bogart is very clearly not in favor of this uranium swindle they're trying to pull off leading to murder. And that opening scene between him and Lola Brigida, where he's angry and he's yelling and he's upset, the scene cuts away to the other characters in the film, and the next time we see Bogart, and then from then on through the rest of the film, there's a huge tonal shift in his character. He goes from upset and feeling a little betrayed to suddenly being very smooth and whimsical. And I mentioned Bond earlier. He's a very wisecracking, smooth operator for the rest of this film. A charming rogue, I guess I would say, where nothing seems to get his feathers ruffled. He never really has any major emotion other than some kind of, you know, laid-back, fatalistic humor until the end of the film when he's afraid for Edward Underdown's character's life. We get to see a little more excitement out of him. But for the most part, Bogart definitely seems to be playing the straight man here. He's playing the guy that's just reacting to a lot of the craziness around him. He is here to react to Robert Morley and Peter Lorre and Mark O'Toole. He's here to take in all the lies that Jennifer Jones gives. He's here to, you know, kind of stifle his temper with Gina Lola Brigida and be annoyingly amused with Edward Underdown's, you know, dowdy British character. He's here to laugh and react and kind of tamper down, you know, the drunken sea captain. And it wasn't until this last viewing that I really realized he's in a lot of the movie, but so much of this film is him listening and reacting to the other characters. And I think, you know, I watched it again last night. My favorite Bogart moment, the classic Bogart moment from the entire film, comes where he has next to nothing to do except to stand there. And that's after the car that he and Robert Morley and his driver were headed down the mountain, and it goes off the cliff without them in it, but it's reported that they were in it and that they're all dead. And then all the characters assemble in the lobby of the hotel as Robert Morley and Bogart happen to walk back in. A really funny scene. Since, you know what, since it's public domain, I'm just going to play it now. And you're not going to hear the best part of Bogart, which is, you know, his just kind of deadpan, dry humor reaction as everybody kind of screams and freaks out around him. A fantastic moment. You know what? I might even throw a picture of that up on Twitter today. That few moments there.
What's the matter with all of you? Somebody dead?
Car. It went over a cliff.
We thought you'd both been killed.
Damn, brother, I'm delighted to see you're alive, but your wife is in a fainting condition.
You mean you're not dead at all?
Obviously, I'm not dead.
I knew you weren't dead. I knew it. I counted 13 backwards 13 times. My old Spanish nurse said if you did that, a miracle would happen. And you see, it has.
Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you the glad tidings. The captain is sober and the SS Nyanga will sail at midnight.
Find me at Bogey Film Blog on Twitter. I am bogeyfilmblog@gmail.com. So you can find me either one of those places or, as I said earlier in the podcast, bogeyfilmblog.wordpress.com or the Bogart Film Affair on iTunes. Have a great week.
Oh, this is the end.